Network, Season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast. Coming at you like the mental organism designed only for killing. Longing for that day when these big, beautiful, womb-wrecking heads of ours are going to dream up fantastic things and change the world by bringing it to its knees. There you go. I am Rylan Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Banjax, and The Jump, the other voice in the dark, the man with the beautiful mustache. To my left is
David Abalone, comics writer, TV writer, coffee achiever.
Yeah, coffee achiever. I love it. I am a little sick today. I believe one of our guests is a little sick, so pardon. We're hobbled, but we're coming to you because we believe
you're a little Lauren Bacall, which is good. It's a good sound for you.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah, that's good. That's good. That's a compliment. Okay, I'm gonna go and change my Twitter or X bio to I'm a little Lauren Bacall. I dig it. If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many, many more, our entire catalog can be celebrated via YouTube and Apple Pods and other purveyors of worthwhile ear cracks. So double on back and check it all out. Great show for you today. Two very wonderful guests that are going to blow minds and dance the jig and do all sorts of good stuff for us. I don't want to set the bar too high, but we should get some house cleaning out of the way before we bring the real people on. So what do you got?
In stores now is Elvira Meets Lovecraft up to issue 4, issue 5 coming in a week or so. And Drawing Blood 1 and 2 with Drawing Blood number 3 coming in a week or so.
Okay. Yeah, that's a lot of good stuff. My standard recent thing, State of Consciousness, is still in some theaters, still available on streaming. I do not necessarily wholeheartedly recommend you go see it, and that's complicated, and you guys have heard that. However, the thing I am excited about, Haunted Heart, out this summer, mark your calendars. Matt Dillon, Fernando Trueba, it's great, it's big, it's bad. I'm very proud of it.
Do you have a release date on that yet? A specific one?
Watch the Twitters. Okay. Watch the Instagams, coming soon. Fair. sold at the Can Market. So there are 3 dates. They're trying to settle which ones. So summer. Peacekeepers 3 and 4 headed to you very soon. Within the next month, and then the next big Kickstarter thing's coming. I'm still we had our big Kickstarter show. I was supposed to, during the Kickstarter show, figure out what I'm bringing to you next, and I did not. If anything, it muddied the waters. So I don't know, maybe our guest today can help me a little bit. Why don't we bring him on and stop
yapping? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Jordan Blum.
Hello everybody, I'm Jordan. Howdy, howdy. I'll just do the intro thing here. This is getting edited, right?
What's that?
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Pat. Hey, welcome. Jordan, tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself.
That's the cue. Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Jordan Blum.
I kept you in everything.
I came in too hard, too fast. I am a TV writer and a comic writer.
Patton Oswalt, I know you were a wedding DJ. What else are you up to?
Oh, wow, nice.
I mean, look. I was a wedding DJ. One day I will return to it. It is my first love.
Sure.
But in the meantime, I'm a comedian, actor, writer, comic writer. But that's just, you know, that's this crazy journey that I'm taking back to the ones and twos, announcing Bill and Debbie Greishman's first dance. And that's going to happen again.
Two questions for you. Do you do 8-year-old birthday parties? And number two, can you do balloon animals?
No and no.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, you know,
do balloon animals, I wouldn't do it because the squeaking would just
squeak
me out so badly.
Nails on a chalkboard, right?
Yeah. That's a lot to ask for. Yeah. So what you guys currently have going on, I went to Golden Apple. I got my Jordan Blum signed.
Signed. Wow.
Number one.
Wow.
And number two. Nice. The first question is, when did you guys start working together? What was your first project together?
Jordan?
It was TV. It was the first pilot I ever sold was with a showrunner I was working for at the time as an assistant. And we sold it to, or before we sold to Fox, we said, who would be the perfect voice for the show, and I said Patton Oswalt, one of my comedy heroes, and Patton came in, and we immediately started talking about Kirby Crackle and all this shorthands. And
Zip-a-tone, you know, baby.
Yeah, oof, it was love at first sight. And then that show did not go. And then Pat and I kind of kept in touch over the years. We'd see each other at Golden Apple. And sure. Then we when would. A certain Marvel project came about, we teamed back up and did that one. And then just haven't stopped writing since.
That was the inspiration of Krang, right? It was MODOK was your first thing together. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like to connect that dot, you know.
Ooh, wow. Well, there you go.
The Krang MODOK connection.
Gotta drag the turtles in every now and again, but I'm contractually required. And MODOK, did you do a comic before the show or was the show first?
Show was first, and then we did a 4-issue Marvel comic that is our attempt. And by the way, it's kind of become canon where we worked in the family that's on the show, how the family actually exists in the Marvel universe. It was really interesting.
Yep. And where we met great. Scott Hepburn, our co-creator yes. of Minor Threats.
Jesus.
Really cool.
And Scott's the artist on was the artist on the MODOK book and is also the artist on this.
Mm-hmm.
On Minor Threats. We saw his initial inks, the early inks for MODOK. They're just the level of detail. And then the level of, again, he is, yes, Jordan and I write as well as we can, but Scott adds visuals and elements there that are so, that are not in our initial writing that just deepens the world. Sure. And he really went to town on that on Minor Threats.
Yeah, and Minor Threats is a very complex and complicated world. I was impressed with that about it. It reminded me of sort of a, it reminded me a little bit of Astro City, actually, just for the sheer number of characters and the scope of what you're doing in it.
It was my first. I mean, it's funny you're talking about the artist because my first reaction was like, wow, these are really dense panels, you know, like in a good way. There's so much going on. And the beauty of it is you read it one time, you kind of get the story, you go back through it and you are then picking things out of panels like, oh, look at that. Oh, look at that. I didn't notice that last time. And that's all the artist. And I mean, the MODOK thing is so interesting because it's like, well, you know, it is something different to draw. That is such a just from a physical standpoint. It is so different from everything. I mean, they're used to, oh, I'm drawing people in capes. I'm drawing people in tights. I'm drawing people who are muscly. And then here's this other thing. And as an artist, it has to be such a break. It's like dessert, you know? That's interesting. And so as an audition for, okay, now, you know, this is going to be the artist for our series. That seems like a pretty good way to go.
Yeah. I think what came out in that series was like, we were like, we're going to tell an emotional roller coaster for a giant floating head. We want you to care. We want to like really get into that giant noggin and understand who he is, why he keeps doing it. And kind of the tragedy of the character, you know, he's like, he's a Kirby, you know, Marvel monster and all those monsters are tormented and, you know, something horrible happened to them that led them to this pursuit of world domination. And we really wanted to kind of, understand that better, you know, than just being sort of the villain of the week that MODOK can sometimes be. And that's obviously also what Minor Threats is. It's, you know, who are these characters, you know, these goofy Silver Age villains and what leads you to kind of live this life as a C-list costume criminal.
It is the sense I got where it's like literally every MODOK comic, I mean, every comic book begins as this guy wants to take over the world or this guy wants to destroy the city or this guy wants to steal this. And then we go on that journey, right? It's like, this is accepted. We're just moving on. You guys are like, wait a minute. Why? How come? Like, let's not move forward until we start to sort through why, you know? It's just it is similar to when I started writing comics. I took a similar approach. You know, it's like, well, I want to understand the psychology here. I'm not, you know,
How much of that comes from, especially what Kirby went through, and a lot of those early artists, Marvel artists, went through. They all went through World War II, and they basically saw this seemingly one-dimensional megalomaniac who was going to take over the world. And I think your brain can't really, that's so terrifying. You know, I think that, you know, it was a one-dimensional megalomaniac, but the brain wants to go, there's got to be, what made that person so, no, some people are just born crazy and horrible, yeah. But it's the human instinct to go, no, there must be a way to bring this person back or make, you know, so you see a lot of that trauma, especially in Kirby's villains.
Yeah.
You see a lot of yeah. little men who are suddenly given a lot of power.
Yeah. Well, and that's us also, right? Where it's like, we grew up and, you know, we did not have a Hitler, thankfully. What we had is let's go to a therapist. For me, it was Zen Buddhism, but it's like, let's get to the root of why we are who we are. We are flawed human beings. Let's sit in a room with somebody and talk about it for hours and figure out what the triggers are and figure out how to untie the knots. And so I feel like, yes, Kirby's generation, they were dealing with that. We're dealing with all of this. We're dealing with our stuff. So MODOK's stuff is our stuff. And so when we write, we are trying to untie those knots, you know, we're getting down in the mud a little bit more. That's interesting. I never thought about it that way.
And you know, it's also where any GI overseas. Yeah. They weren't having a one-on-one with Hitler, but they met German soldiers. They met German people. They met people that went along with it and were, you know, had to puzzle that out for themselves and had to have sort of a human face-to-face with people they were previously shooting at. And that's, that, you know, that's that, scarring and also, you know, for want of a better term, broadening. It is something where you're seeing another world and wondering, you know, what if I was the guy in the field gray uniform growing up here and wondering and this all happened in my culture. But was the MODOK series something you guys pitched, or did Marvel want a MODOK series? That seems unlikely to me, but anything is possible. But
that came from us. That was our first instinct. Yeah. Hey, that's, you want a Marvel TV show? Yes, it has to be MODOK.
That's great. Yeah.
But yeah, no, they had some other ideas for other things. And I think, you know, we knew they wanted something that was sort of a family animated comedy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to me, the idea of like these big arch villains and, you know, where do they go? What happens, you know, when they leave the panel? Like where does MODOK go home to? And the idea of there being a whole other world, you know, I think that's what excited Pat and I the most.
Yeah.
One of the panels in comics that's haunted me for so long and really kind of informed how I think of comics. There's a panel in Suicide Squad, the original Ostrander run, where Captain Boomerang is sneaking out at night and doing crimes. But when he comes back in the day, he's got to get in his boomerang outfit. And in his room, in his cell, there's all these extra boomerang outfits just hanging haphazardly from hangers. And I was like, oh yeah, they've got to have, he can't just have one uniform. So like the little mundane thing. And also he got those cleaned and then hung those on those different hangers to have them ready. Like these guys have to do mundane shit. There's something really just awesome about that. I don't know why.
Yeah. You know, and especially after years of seeing the stuff delivered by writers and artists who aren't interested in asking the question, and again, that was the genius of Astro City was all about, like, well, what if, you know, why is Batman only out at night? Like, maybe he's a vampire. Maybe Clark finds Lois Lane really fucking annoying in her attempts to out him. To the public. And that, you know, that's always the job, isn't it, of writing, right? is you come to the cliche situation and you ask yourself, okay, there's nothing that we're going to write that hasn't been done 1,000 times. And you always have to ask yourself, what is the way this hasn't been done? What is the English I can put on this ball? And, you know, starting with MODOK is, of course, a great way to go, well, no one cared about this, you know, since Jack Kirby, no one has really given a shit about MODOK. So, you know, and I think when you're pitching stuff to Marvel, they expect you to want to write Spider-Man. They don't expect you to come at them with MODOK. I had a conversation with Joe Quesada once, and he asked me what Marvel character I would write. And I think I said Nick Fury, and he was kind of like, really? Really? That's, you know, not Captain America, Nick Fury. Huh? Okay. And at the time, Garth Ennis was doing what he did with that character. So he was like, yeah, no, that's not available right now.
But I think what you see is that all these characters, though, have the potential to be a main character. Like, you know, Ant-Man, Guardians of the Galaxy, like those movies alone are like proof that like there's something about the underdogs, the unwanted, you know, and I think in the right hands, those become A-list characters from a character point of view.
I mean, we're so saturated with the other characters. I mean, that's the thing is there have been, you know, we have done Captain America backwards and forwards. So it's not to say that like there's not going to be another great Captain America story. However, there are a lot of options have been taken off the table, right? But yeah, you start to get into, you know, you could, you know, particularly a few years ago, you could really do something amazing with Ant-Man.
It's a thing as a writer that the underutilized character, you've got some room to explore there. You know, I've been trying to pitch a Batman thing, and it's just like, I don't know what he has. Like, I'm not Mark Waid. I don't know everything Batman has done since 1938. I don't. I need to pull a lifeline and go, has Batman ever? I'm sure he has. And when you're writing, you know, when I'm working for Dynamite, when I'm writing The Shadow or whatever, it's like, well, there aren't 7,000 issues of The Shadow. I'm on pretty safe ground here that not only am I doing something new, but if it was done in 1939, no one has read it since 1939. So I'm probably pretty safe.
Someday they will let me do the ludicrous Tyrese Gibson Fast and Furious spinoff, and they will have to invent a new Oscar for it. is all I'm saying. Call me Universal.
Waiting there for you.
Sitting right there.
Of Minor Threats, did you got just something you guys cooked up?
Interestingly enough, it was a Batman story that I had. I had this idea for a story called Jay, and it was a total riff on Fritz Lang's M. But basically, it was the Joker has broken out of Arkham Asylum, and Batman and the Bat Family are coming down like a ton of bricks on Gotham City to capture him. So, who gets hit first is all the C-level yeggs that they're working their way up to figure out where he is. So I put a collection of Batman's villains who start with a C. Calendar Man, Calculator, Crime Doctor, Crazy Quilt, Copperhead. They were literally going to be a C-list.
Literally the C-list.
And they were going to go, well, you know, if we hand the Joker over, we'll get some credit with Batman. I'd rather be in good with Batman than be in good with the Joker, because all the Joker does is just eventually. I wanted to look at Gotham crime from like the professional point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not here to put smiles on the fishes. I want to rob banks and get money. Like, this is a profession for me. But we had done all this work. I'd done a lot of work for the major, so at Jordan, and it's a lot of work for really no money and nothing. And, so Jordan was like, well, why don't we just make our own universe? And we just built it from there. Like, then once we got that idea, then we just ran with it. It was just really fun. Same idea, though. Major villain breaks out, or in this case, a major villain kills the sidekick of a major hero. So now everything has changed. A line has been crossed, and everything's about to go down the shitter. So the D-list is like, we got to do something.
Right. Well, that's a great
to save the city to save ourselves.
That's a great inspiration. I don't know. I stumbled across once. Did you know there is a Miami Vice episode that's a remake of M? Episode of Miami Vice.
Wow.
Where there's a serial killer in Miami, and Miami's drug dealers get together and find him, and Crockett undercover is his defense attorney in the trial.
That's right. Yeah, they do a mock trial in the original, and then what's really tragic is they remade M is a brilliant movie, one of the all time greats. But then they remade it in the '50s. Joseph Losey did it. David Wayne in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Huh.
I think David Wayne played the Peter Lorre part.
Yes, and it's so fucking good. But everyone's like, how dare you remake M, this classic, and it didn't do it. But you watch now, people recognize what a brilliant movie it is. And it's also weird. It's a weirdly accurate documentary of what L.A. looked like in the 50s. Angels Flight is in it. There's areas of downtown that are now gone. They all shot it handheld. It's incredible.
I'll have to look that up. I've known of its existence for years. I've just never seen it. The great, and I gift this to you and everybody answering, whenever anybody does the reboots remakes nonsense, I always say your favorite version of the Maltese Falcon is the third one.
Is the third one.
There you go.
So you know, like, They made three of those in less than 10 years. That's how badly they were trying to make that a hit out of that movie. So,
yeah.
And I think the first one had Betty Davis in it, for God's sakes.
Uh-huh. I think that's the middle one. That's okay. Satan Met a Lady has
Betty Davis in it.
And that's even more of like a comedy than the first one. And the you know, the book, for its time, the book was pretty sexual. I mean, now it doesn't seem that way. So the first one is mostly about how horny Sam Spade is. And then the second one is they take that even farther and make it a comedy. And then John Huston had the crazy idea of shooting the book.
I just love the fact that John Huston and his writers were able to sneak in the term gunzel, which everyone at the time thought, well, that's a hired gun. Yep. No, that's Yiddish slang for a rent boy.
Yeah, I love it.
So Elijah Cook Jr. is Sidney Greenstreet's little rent boy.
Yeah, Catamite, I think, is the
other.
Then
they go, you had a boy in Istanbul. He goes, yeah, I'll just get another one. Like, when they hand him over to the cops.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, no, it's, I think, the Yiddish, it's Yiddish for goose. Your little goose. Your little gunzel. And if you look, that's a case of pop culture actually changing the dictionary, because now if you look in a dictionary, it literally, definition number one is hired gunman, and definition number two is catamite, young man used as sexual toy of it's pretty, I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty clear in the movie. I don't think it's that, you know, they but it is a case of Hammett going, if I say the thing out loud, they will take this out, so let me come up with the most obscure piece of jargon. You did use yeg successfully in a sentence earlier, which I'm very impressed by. A lot of people don't drag out yeg.
I love old slang. I collect old slang, especially the stuff, the musicality of the 30s slang is just
It's fantastic.
Like a lot of hobo slang, like scraping the pavement means you're shaving.
Yeah. Did you ever read, you must have read You Can't Win.
Yes, by Jack Black.
Yeah. Not the other Jack Black, but
No.
Yeah. I recommend that to everyone. That's an amazing book. I'm stunned it hasn't been filmed, because it's got to be PD by now. But it's a low level criminal from the turn of the century writing about what it was like to be a criminal, and it's an amazing book. It's just it's a vivid travelogue of America and some of Canada, and just, I always remember the thing in it about how I think about that book every time I see chloroform in a movie, because he tells a story about trying to use chloroform to rob an opium parlor, and he's like, the minute you take the cap off the bottle, you pass out. Like, he's like, people don't understand. You can't, weaponizing chloroform is not actually, I'll unscrew the top, put a rag on it. No, you wake up with the bottle in your hand.
If you put it on a cloth and put it on someone's face, it takes a long time. Yeah. They have a long time to fight you off, and there's people around them will stop you.
Yeah. It's just completely.
It was a convenient thing that they needed in the movies, like punching someone and they pass out immediately.
Yeah.
Because you got to move the plot along, but it actually doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing as someone who was stabbed once, and that's a long story. I love it in movies where someone is stabbed in a non-vital organ and just dies immediately.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, they're going to be bleeding for like 4 hours. They have plenty of time to get to a hospital. Yeah, like that's actually pretty. That's pretty mild stuff compared to something
that'll
kill you.
I worry about Jim Rockford. You know, we are in the age of CTE. You know, football players, you know, take a couple of hits and it horribly. Jim Rockford was bonked on the head in every episode. Yeah. There were over 100 episodes. The number of concussions that guy sustained in like a 5 to 7 year period is truly extraordinary. And I don't think he was doing too well in his 50s.
Yeah, I'm not as worried about him as I'm worried about Mannix. Mannix was shot in the same shoulder at least 25 times. I'm amazed that arm didn't fall off.
Well, I think the third time, it's hitting some pretty rough scar tissue.
Yeah, so exactly. It's not getting that arm on anymore.
Yeah, no, my father actually, in the Ed Noon novels, he did the bonked on the head thing. And sometime in the middle of the series, a doctor said to him, you know, your guy has brain damage now, and it is easily confused. Wow. And from the rest of the book, for the rest, for the other 15 novels, it's knockout drops in a drink and it's chloroform. Like, he went, okay, I will stop having him get tranquilizer darts, I guess, will do from here on in. Like,
whatever. That's always a good one, though.
Yeah. Yeah. So how many issues did the first Minor Threats run?
Oh, four back issues. To our comic. Thanks.
we can get away from 1930s criminal slang for a minute.
That was the biggest detour. Okay, no, I love that detour.
This is a show of detours, encouraged and embraced. And yeah,
us back to the subject matter every now and
then. Yeah. This is literally as on track as we have ever been. Usually we are arguing about Star Trek captains 10 minutes in and we never get back. So bravo to David.
Yeah. Go ahead. But yeah,
right. Oh, it was four issues was the original series, and then we did sort of a semi spinoff called the Alternates, which mm-hmm. we did with Tim Seeley, and and now we're back with volume two, which is another four issues, and three just came out today, so it'll be in stores, I guess, whenever this goes up.
Yes, this will be out in a week, so three will have been out for a minute. But yeah, that's great. And is there plans for volume three? Are you looking forward?
Yeah, there's discussions. And then Barfly, which is a spinoff that Kyle Starks and Ryan Brown are doing, that comes out in July. And then there's a lot of other stuff that hasn't been announced yet, but we'll probably be talking about it.
So building an entire Minor Threats-iverse at Dark Horse.
Scott Hepburn's art. Barfly by Starks and Brown, that is literally inspired by a single panel in the first issue of the book.
She won, right? Yeah.
Little guy and went, that guy, I have a story for him.
That's amazing. That's great.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Ryan Brown's. We have the God Hates Astronauts omnibus here, which is you could kill a man with it. It's a large physical object. It's not quite Starenko coffee table edition.
Starenko.
It's pretty big.
He's doing some incredible stuff with the book in that the character doesn't talk. So he's communicating what he's feeling through sound effects. Yeah. So it'll be like he punches a guy. It's like super pissed off is the sound effect.
Yeah. That is my favorite Ryan Brown tick. There's a panel in God Hates Astronauts where someone is being threatened with imminent death, and there's a sound effect coming out of their pants that is pants shit.
Nice.
And I'm like, well, there it is. Like, you can't, why not just use the thing itself? Who knows what that sounds like? Let's just.
I think the best one I've ever done was I had written Whitney Houston's "I Will Always Love You" into a scene. And the lyrics are kind of spilling out, and that was very melodic. But then, you know, there was this really incredible saxophone solo right in the middle of it that you just feel, and you got to feel it in the book. And I got together with the letter, and I'm like, how do we do this? And it says like sweet sax solo, and it's like it is like the sexiest lettering you've ever seen in your life. It was just he just nailed it, you know. That's the best. It's like.
I gotta say, sound effects, I don't know about you guys, coming in, I started writing comics at 49. I think it was not an early career for you, Patton. But that was the thing I struggled with the most, with sound effects. And I still kind of just feel like, do I really? Sure, that was the most uncinematic thing to me, was having to be like, no, the gun... Okay, let me put in all of these effects now.
Yeah.
And I still will sometimes go running to an old comic book and go, how do we express this? I recently did a comic with Elvira meeting Godzilla, and I found the old Godzilla comic, and like, I'm going to find out how they rendered, render that? And it's Skriank. By the way, if you were wondering.
Wait a minute, was that the one where it's Godzilla versus S.H.I.E.L.D. or just his own comic?
No, it was his. I looked up Godzilla King of the Monsters number one. That is sure to give me a solid Godzilla sound effect. And because you can always break the fourth wall with Elvira, she looks at it and goes, I wondered how you spelled that.
Another detour, but God, the Elvira meeting H.P. Lovecraft is pure bliss.
Well, thank you, sir.
God, I am loving that comic so much, and the cringe of him trying to, instead, it's even cringier when he's trying to go, no, I'm actually evolved and woke, and getting it even wronger.
Sure.
Than if he, you know what I mean? It, oh my God, it's the best. Yeah,
look, thank you. We've all had the experience. We all have the people in our lives who will not catch up.
Nope.
No matter how hard you try and help them catch up. And yeah, I felt that in order to get the story started, HB had to at least claim to have changed.
That's what when he claims to have changed, that's when I was like, oh God, this is going to be even worse than we imagined. This is going to be so bad.
Yeah, that was
it's the best. Oh,
thank you. That was the, and the thing is, like, going all the way back to the fourth issue of Elvira, I was going to use him as a character in one issue, and I just went, I can't deal with all that baggage in 20 pages. I need way more pages to give him the whole crazy arc that he needs to be a character in this.
Yeah.
Because I didn't need that much time for the first three were Mary Shelley, Bram Stoker, and Poe. And of course, I always like to say when people bring up what a shitty person Lovecraft was, Poe, a way worse than
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolute.
Well, like, Lovecraft was
sitting at home. Like, Lovecraft wasn't out in the street screaming slurs at people. He was sitting at home being quietly racist in letters to his friends about
Lovecraft people he had never met. Lovecraft was evil in thought. Poe was evil in deed. He
got like,
shit done.
Yeah, Poe married a 12-year-old for her money.
Right. Like, although I will say that people...
As one does.
People that defend Lovecraft and go, well, you know, he was a product of his time.
Oh,
no,
that's
no. Listen. People were racist back then, but racists didn't think that black people came from space. Yeah. He took it to another level where I think even Klansmen were like, no, I think they're born on Earth, man. I don't.
They're from over there in Africa. Yeah. They're not from another dimension.
I have family in Tennessee now, and some people there still think that. Just to be clear. It's very unfortunate, but.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a. It is that thing. It's like so much of it. It comes from just complete ignorance and fear of everything. There's a line in the book where he says something about being unsettled by air travel, and she's like, "You're unsettled by shellfish. Like everything unsettles you. That's the whole problem you have. Is that you know?"
Somebody, maybe you tweeted this or someone or put it on Threads. They're like, "Oh, that." The contents of H.P. Lovecraft's imagination. What it's like, wait a minute. H.P. Lovecraft's deepest fears were riding on an elevator with a woman or eating spicy food. Like those were his deepest fears.
Yeah. There's a Ray Bradbury short story. I can't remember the title of it, where all of the dead authors are living on Mars. And I think Poe is trying to get an army together to repel the invasion. And he goes to Lovecraft, and Lovecraft won't leave his room. And Poe turns to one of his henchmen and says, "Send him a dozen lobsters." Like that's his attack on Lovecraft is send him a dozen lobsters. That'll send him into a coma.
He's right. He's absolutely right.
Yeah, and that's the that's sad. You know, like it's not
that's what's about our book again.
Well, here's my, you know, if I can, we are a film and comics business podcast, first and foremost, you know, and I mean, I'm interested in, you guys seem to be moving full force into comics, expanding, you know, your presence there. And we have talked a lot about, you know, how the film business is on fire right now, the film and TV business. How much is your, you know, your full force push in the comics? How much does it have to do with that, with how crazy film and TV is right now?
Not as related. I think like the comic stuff is, you know, something we just love doing. You know, very, very grateful to be working right now in film and TV, but you know, I think to me it's more of a reaction, right, to like you know, maybe the things you're going to be allowed to do in film and TV might shrink in scope, and being able to explore weirder ideas, I think comics is a much safer place for. So, for budgetary reasons.
Once we started doing comics, Jordan was like, I had no idea it was this much fun. Yeah. Like, if this paid what movies and TV paid, this is all I'd be doing.
Yeah.
And he's right. Like, it is such a much more malleable, and there's so much less editorial interference in comics that I was shocked to see, because the people that are even editors in comics are like, they're not in it for the money. They're in it because they love it. So when they see someone even taking a foolish risk, they're more prone to go, let's fucking print this. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, but look, the budget of the average comic book put out by a real publisher is what, maybe between $8,000 and $12,000.
Mm-hmm. That is not even a day's catering
for a company.
That's not even a day's worth of catering.
It's just not a heavy risk to take. And I had the same reaction to it you did, Pat. And when I wrote my very first script for my very first comic a decade ago and handed it in, I got no response from editorial. And I called up a colleague and I was like, oh, I guess he hates it. I guess it sucks. And my friend who'd been in comics a long time laughed and said, dude, somebody's drawing it right now. Like, you have no idea. Like, they're shooting your script. Like, you think you're waiting for six guys to come back with notes. They're shooting your movie right now. It's happening.
I love it.
They have no time to tell. They have
no time. But isn't that how writers are?
They just want to keep going. You know?
Isn't that how writers are, where all we do is complain about the notes we get?
Yeah.
Why don't they fucking let me do my thing? And then you send something in and you're like, well, you know, I'd love to know do you have any problems with, you want to know that someone read it enough, but they have a critique of it. But then also you don't want the notes that are going to make you change your vision. So we're never happy.
I think my editor at Dynamite, Joe Ryban, has heard me joke about his lack of response enough on podcasts that I now get a 2-sentence email back saying, great script.
Yeah. Just so you know, I read it. Just so you know. Yeah. I read this one.
I read it. Good. Yeah. Thanks.
That's funny.
But look, that's the, you know, you're talking about the compared to everything else we do.
Yeah.
That thing where a page arrives in email and it's late, it's fucking Christmas morning every other day.
Yeah.
And
you I had spent 10 to 12 years writing movies that didn't get made, you know, and it paid well, like you said, you know, film and TV were pays pretty well. However, I wrote a lot of great stuff that I never saw. And the first time, you know, I wrote a comic script, I sent it off and I had an inked page a couple of days later and I literally cried. My journey was similar, where it was like, I think I had been writing for, again, probably 10 or 12 years before I took a shot at this. And, you know, I came up in the Sundance movement. I went to AFI. I got my snooty director's education. I saw Pulp Fiction when I was a kid, and I said, I want to do that. But by the time I got out here, we weren't allowed to do that anymore, right? And so I get pigeonholed in this weird way, you know, writing action movies, you know. And I've written some good stuff for some good people, and it certainly beats working. But over time, what you could do in Hollywood got smaller and smaller and smaller. I feel like you can fit it on a postage stamp right now. I feel like for me, there were like five different kinds of movies I could write. They all wanted them written a certain way. And, I got pretty good at writing those. They bought my house or whatever, but I was miserable. You know, it was like, I sound like a moron complaining because I got paid to write movies, because there are a lot of people that would, you know, trade places with me. However, it felt like I might as well be laying bricks or something, right? And there was part of me that would almost rather be laying bricks, because I'd be outside, I'd be, you know, the grass is always greener and all that. But so somebody said very aggressively, you should try comics. Like, there's something for you there, I promise you. Yes. And I didn't understand it until, you know, Jordan, like you said, I did it for the first time. And it was just like, wow, like anything is possible here. It's like in comics, any story you want to tell, you can tell it anyway. As long as it is good, you will find an audience for it. And so when I did it, I promised myself that I was never going to tell an A to B to C standard classic cookie cutter story, that I was going to double down on experimental elements and play with structure and unreliable narrators and the whole nine yards. You know, my second book, Banjax, it's a Batman and Robin story, Patton, kind of like you're talking about. But something has gone horribly wrong. The odd issues are told from the Batman's point of view. The even issues are told from the Robin's point of view, and they're telling very different stories. And so you don't know what the truth is. In the end, you are left to determine what the truth is. And it was bonkers. It was batshit crazy. Issue 4 is told from the point of view of someone who hasn't slept for like 6.5 days, and it is literally driving him crazy. And so you don't know if what he's seeing is real or not, and where that begins and ends. And it was just like, that was, if I tried to do that in a movie, I would have been fired on day 3 or something like that. But it was soul food.
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Another thing that really kind of informed Jordan and I's writing is we don't, and you can, this is more about comics as well. When we write each 4-issue arc of Minor Threats, we're not writing it with the thought of, and then what's the sequel going to be? What's the franchise going to be? Mm-hmm. We put everything we have into each one as its own freestanding story. And if it's popular enough, yeah, then we'll do a sequel. But I think a lot of times in movies, you are expected to give them something that they can maybe turn into a franchise. And you've got to have those thoughts in your mind. If you put out 4 issues and it bombs in comics, you haven't wasted that much money and resources. Right. You know, so you can go and really put all of your heart and soul into one thing. That's another huge advantage to comics. And in a way, it makes our comics more cinematic because we're not hedging our bets and going, yeah, let's save that for volume 2. No, we're putting it all in this right now.
No, you see that so much. You know, someone made that. I'm sure you probably saw the tweet about, was it Surf Dracula? I can't remember. What someone said that, like, a streaming series called Surf Dracula, like, that was 10 episodes. He wouldn't get on a surfboard until episode 10 and fight his first Dracula. Like, in a comic book in the old days, like in the 1960s TV series, he's on the surfboard in the opening credits.
The song explains how he got on a surfboard and fought vampires.
That slow burn thing on TV. It was a divisive series, but I remember Jonathan Nolan, who I will call the talented one, someone asked him about Westworld and the various seasons, and he said, we have thoughts about what could happen next, but he's like, I'm trying to leave it all on the table every single time. I want to do a good season of television. I put in everything that I want to do. And then when they pick us up, I go, what threads did I leave hanging that I can follow up on? And I think that's the only way to really do it. If you're holding back, oh, this is a really great scene, but let's not get Surf Dracula on the board just yet. We need to know about his childhood. We need to know about, and it's like, come on, man.
But we really do that. You know, Jordan had that great idea of, let's do flashbacks in each issue about one specific character so we can go really deep and get a lot of big emotional moments. Yeah. And again, make a great look. I'm all for story arcs as well, but just like what's so funny about Truth, Justice, and the American Way, what's wrong with a brilliant issue of a comic book? You know what I mean? What is it? Pizza is my business. What is wrong with like making a absolutely perfect freestanding issue of a comic and making that the thing that people like? So we go for that a lot with Mind of Threats.
It should be a full meal, right? It shouldn't just be, you know, part one of whatever. Oh. And I think even though we're telling serialized storytelling, we make sure that like you get that full story from this character's point of view. They arc, they have their kind of history they're sharing with you.
You do see it. I mean, and you see it in some comics now too, the toxic effect of the streaming storytelling model, where someone will just neglect to tell you a satisfying story in 20 pages.
I remember.
Give me a cliffhanger. That's fine. Give me 19 pages of good story, and then dark side on page 20, so I know that something's coming in the next issue. But give me a story.
When Justified was still on the air, there was, you know, there was an overall arc for the season. It's a crime saga, whatever. Yeah. But in season one, there's an episode called The Whole Tooth, and it stars Alan Ruck as
Alan Ruck,
who owes money. And the episode is from his point of view. Colson is a guest star in his own series, and that in that episode. Yeah. And I was reading it is one of the best like just episodes of TV ever. It's like this perfect short film. And I remember reading reviews of it because I used to follow the AV Club all the time. They would write great episodic reviews. And I remember that line going, "I'm all for serialized and story arcs, but if you're going to do episodes this good, then fuck story arcs.
Yeah,
I'll just watch a great short film every week.
Yeah,
like what's wrong with that?" And I always remember that, like, oh, that's right. You can just do a great self-contained. It's its own thing. You never have to visit it again. They never brought Alan Ruck back. It was his own perfect story, and it's done.
Yeah, and Justify was so good at that, where it was like, you know, because we think in this, you know, it's binary. It's either, well, it's case of season or it's case a week. And Justify somehow struck this balance of there was a case every week, but there was also this more meaty case every season also that came to a head in a really satisfying way. And that was definitely like a masterwork in terms of that stuff. Yeah,
I think Strange New Worlds has also kind of done a good job with that.
It's
serialized, but they've still gone the like, no, every week there's kind of got to be a new planet and a new alien race and a new interesting thing happening. Yeah. And then we wrap that up. And we've got the bubbling thing with Spock and Chapel, and we've got, you know, Una is worried about being outed as a genetic and all that kind of, every week, I mean, and if you go back and look at television in the 70s, like sitcoms are all these brilliant one-act social realist one-act plays. You know, every episode of Barney Miller is a, you know,
feels like it
deserves a fucking Pulitzer now. You know,
you're watching a great, I mean, and by the way, even a show like The Sopranos had an overall arc would do episodes like College. College is a perfect short film. Perfect.
Yeah.
I think we're returning a little bit to episodic being, like, I think it was thrown out completely.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, hey, we've got to do this artful masterpiece, you know, it's a giant movie over 10 episodes. And I think now you're looking at a lot of the habits and like people are just going back to old sitcoms, procedurals.
Yeah. Poker Face. Yeah. Poker Face is a good one. Yeah. You talk about Rockford Files and everything. It's like, oh, wow, we have this back. I've been needing this. Yeah. That's funny.
There's a return. Well, I wanted to go back to what you were saying of like TV and film versus comics. And, you know, it was discussed, you know, very early on, we handed in the pitch, you know, Dark Horse Productions, who we love working with, was like, let's go take it out and as a show or a movie or something. And we were very specific, like we have to figure out the story and write it as a comic first. We don't want to think about this in that way, because they are such different mediums. And we want to figure out how to tell this in the best way with the tools you have in comics and make it the best comic. So they were very cool about being patient while we got to just build it organically as a comic. Because I think I read stuff sometimes, I'm like, this is someone's failed movie or pilot or something.
Yes.
They just cut and pasted into a comic. And we were very, you know, obviously sensitive about that. So, you know, to us, we just were like, this is only a comic. This only exists as a comic. Let's have fun with it as we figure it out.
Now, had either of you written a comic, even just sort of speculatively for laughs, before MODOK?
Yeah, I had done some stuff for DC. I did a single issue of Black Hammer.
Oh, that's right.
And I did a prestige one for the Justice League, and I'd done some Batman stories. So, I mean, I knew it also took me a while to realize, oh, your artist is your cinematographer. You don't need to describe every single thing and every... You can describe an action, they can go, here's how we're going to shoot it.
Yeah.
Here's how we'll, and so once I learned that, that was great.
Everyone's got their own thing. Alan Moore is the director that tells the cinematographer what
he's Kubrick.
I'm going to tell you how high off the ground the camera is going to be and how
far.
Who has time to write a full page panel description?
And he does it in all caps, like he's shouting at you in text. It's very disconcerting.
And look, if you know that has produced some great comics. So who am I?
Alan Moore.
He's done a few decent things.
But it's great to give people the freedom. To come up with something. I did the issue of Elvira where she's an alien there's one panel, and literally the panel description is Medium on Elvira. And she, in the dialogue, she's explaining to the crew of the Nostromo that they're all going to die horribly. And Sylvia Califano, God bless her, the back of the panel behind her, what's over her shoulder, is a Pac-Man field with a little Tom Skerritt head and a little Harry Dean Stanton head. And the alien is the Pac-Man going around. It's just a brilliant visualization of the joke. I didn't think of it. She completely. There's also one in the Psycho issue where she's talking to Norman Bates about the showers in the hotel rooms. And when I got the page, it had this musical notation behind it. And I looked and I'm like, oh, it's the same high note repeated. This is Bernard Herrmann's The Murder. Literally just cut and pasted behind the character. But yeah, no, that, I mean, it, I didn't know that the origin story, I thought that you, Jordan, you and Patton had known each other before auditioning him for something. So that's great.
Yeah. I mean, no, we had met, and we did a full presentation for Fox for that pilot. So, you know, Patton was a producer on it with us and got to direct him and an amazing cast and got to make this 14-minute short that would be the show that never aired. But it was fun to find a fellow geek. And
has that short ever snuck out into the real world?
No, you know, I'm not good at liking the things I did in the past. So I don't know if I was my first pilot. Look at that. The cast, though, you would never in a million years be able to get together. Like J.K. Simmons, Ben Schwartz was in it. It was unbelievable. And it was like, it was in the moment a great thing we were very excited about. But we got to work those demons out later on MODOK. You know, we didn't get to make that. Animated superhero show, but we got to make another one.
I have to say, as a writer, that's always been, every time you get that note of take this thing that's the most beautiful thing in the script and throw it in the garbage, please. I just always think it'll come, you know, I will be paid again for this. these words will reappear in something else and it'll be just fine.
The guys who wrote Somewhere That's Green for Little Shop of Horrors and it didn't get nominated for an Oscar, they went, okay, well, fuck it. And then they did Part of Your World. They basically just did the same song in Little Mermaid and got the Oscar. They're like, it's too good a song. You guys are wrong. We're doing it again. They got the Oscar.
Run that shit back out.
Run it again. You guys missed it. We're giving you another chance. Here we go.
You never know, like Kander and Ebb shit out New York, New York in 5 minutes after Scorsese and De Niro turned down whatever beautiful thing they wrote first. And they were like, well, let's write the worst song in the history of mankind. And I agree with them on that assessment, by the way. And De Niro and Scorsese with their lovely tin ears were like, no, this is the best. This movie's going to be a huge hit because of this song. You never know. Nobody knows anything, as someone once observed. Have you guys got any comic plans beyond the Minor Threat-iverse, or is that taking up all of that space in your heads right now?
Small stuff and like anthologies and stuff, but we're not, I don't think we have the bandwidth to do too much else in comics. I think I have one thing I'm doing, but beyond that, I think we're, you know, there's a lot of Minor Threats coming out and we're all hands on deck.
I would say, you know, looking at it from the outside, there is a very significant payday and you know, celebratory party waiting for you on Kickstarter should you guys ever decide to take something over there. So it's such an interesting audience now. Like, you know, a lot of the business is moving over there. I think you guys would do very well, like worth your while well. So I don't know, sniffing out like look at what Keanu did on Kickstarter, you know.
It's a great venue.
Look what Elvira does on Kickstarter, you know. It doesn't preclude you from then, you know, going to Image with it, as Mr. Avalone has proven.
Yes. Well, you know, it is a funny thing because everyone's like, oh my god, that's so exciting, you have an Image comic, and I was like, it's great. You realize they don't pay anything, right? You're familiar with that part of this
whole thing. Yeah.
I have no complaints about that. The deal is the deal, and it's a good one, as long as you somewhere along the line found some money in the street that allowed you to produce your comic book elsewhere, and then you can give them the pages. And again, it is their business model, and it's a good one. And I love the, you know, the whole not taking any of the media part is pretty rare out there in comic book land. So there's a lot to be said for that. But you guys have been happy with the experience at Dark Horse.
Oh yeah.
Oh amazing. God. Yeah. They've been so supportive.
So amazing. That's great.
But yeah, I've seen a lot of the success on Kickstarter, and it's such a great place to just take that thing and do it yourself and build your audience. And
I mean, you know, it's not free money in that it's a month of work while you're trying to get people to, but at the end of the day, it feels a lot like free money.
And there are people that would run the campaign for you guys if you needed it. There are people who would fulfill for you if you needed it. And I mean, you guys could make a small killing there with the right projects. I mean, you know, that's what's selling right now. You guys have a lot of momentum, so it's good. But yeah, I feel like maybe even 2 years ago there were like maybe four or five Dark Horses, and now Dark Horse is the only Dark Horse. You know, these publishers that really have some momentum. It's a really good situation. You're getting great support from them. All of that stuff. That is interesting to me. I mean, because I, you know, as a guy who, I was on the 2 yard line at IDW twice and had deals flushed because of, you know, because they had to fire 60% of the staff both times, and overnight, you know, did not have a working email address at the company. It is so rare, I think right now to have what you guys probably have at Dark Horse.
They've endured since the 80s, right? Yeah. And I think are good at navigating the market and putting out stuff that was always counter to Marvel and DC. And, you know, they had a lot of licenses, lost some of those licenses, and then kind of.
Yeah, I remember when they had Star Wars.
Yeah, they had Star Wars. So I think now it's very creator focused. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, why we were brought in, and you know, I'm excited by a ton of the books they have coming out. Some amazing
it's a great line. I mean, but yeah, you go back to the 80s when I was starting to really get serious about comics. The idea that of Dark Horse, Comico, First, and Eclipse, only Dark Horse would still be standing in 30 years.
Yeah,
is wild. Like you know. Those seemed like very, very strong companies with incredible product lines, and the market did not support them terribly long, which is pretty wild here. But let us wrap up. I wanted to. Where can people find you next? I know that Minor Threats 3 comes out June 6th.
Today comes out D-Day.
So that is in stores now. If you go to Golden Apple in Los Angeles, you might find the rare signed Jordan Blum copy of that.
and we have plenty of signings coming up. Check our social media feeds. We'll be all over.
You know what the next one is offhand?
I think I want to say early July. Ryan Brown will be in LA, so we'll be doing some signings with him. Those will be announced
Wednesday, July 10th. It's looking like
okay.
You know where it'll be.
There's going to be one at Golden Apple, and then one at Things from Another World at Universal Studios, where you can ride the movie.
Nice. You know, City Walk. The first place I looked around and went, "Oh, so they built Blade Runner for real? Cool.
Yeah. Too bad.
Cool. They built the garish nightmare world of the future. Awesome. Yes.
But suffice to say, that store is fantastic.
Yeah, it is. There,
it's amazing because you get fans, but you also get people who are excited, traveling, who are like, oh my God, there's a comic signing. I want to check this out. Because sometimes, as you know, when you sign, we do a lot of signings in Los Angeles, you know, there's only so many comic readers, to go around. So it's a great way to still be in LA and kind of diversify your signings.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That makes sense. Awesome. And Jordan, where can people find you on the interwebs?
I'm Bloom Jordan on Twitter and Instagram and all of those, Blue Sky. But we now have a Minor Threats handle that someone is running for us, which is the best way to find out about Minor Threats. And that is the Minor Threats DH handle.
Nice. And Patton, where can the kids find you online?
Pat at Patton Oswalt, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, PattonOswalt.com. All my tour dates are up. A lot of traveling everywhere this summer, and I'll be at Comic-Con with Jordan. So,
oh, cool. So you guys will be
everywhere. We'll be everywhere.
Yeah, we have a panel on Thursday at 11:30. So there'll be a Minor Threats panel. They're about 10 minutes.
Nice. Yeah.
And at a reasonable hour.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Have breakfast and come see us.
Nice. Ryland, where can the kids at home find you?
I am at Ryland Grant on all forms of social media. Most of you are listening on Apple Pods, so I will spell that for you. R-Y-L-E-N-D-G-R-A-N-T. I always spell it because it is not a real name. My parents just kind of drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it, and so now I have to spell it for you. But yeah, that's a one-stop shop. If you missed out on Peacekeepers, you can go to backerkit.peacekeepers.com and, you know, find all the goodies there. You find everything Jump there, a bunch of rare signed con variants. It's a one-stop Ryland Grant shop, so check that out. Yeah.
Nice.
Bring us home.
And davidavalonifreelance.com, because GoDaddy are bastards and they sat on davidavalone.com. Don't know why. I'm not somebody who's going to spend $10,000 on their domain name from you, just FYI. And my next appearance when this airs will be June 22nd. I'm doing something called Comics and Cocktails, which I've been told is very insensitive to Iron Man because he's an alcoholic.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
See, I've been wanting to check that out. I might see you there.
It's a really fun event. And me aside, they have really great guests this time. They have Jerry Conway is going to be there, and Joe Rubenstein and Dennis Cowan, I think, is going to be there. It's a nice group. But that's where you can find me. Pat and Jordan, thank you so much for joining us. This was lovely.
Thank you, guys. Fabulous,
man. And go pick up Minor Threats, kids.
Awesome. Thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more Madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.